Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good morning. Thank you all for joining us today. Welcome to LSE for today's hybrid event, Power, Politics and Belonging, the Lasting Impacts of Colonialism, which forms part of the LSE Festival Power and Politics. My name is Fabrício Fialho, and I'm a research fellow at the LSE International Inequalities Institute, working in the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity program. I'm very pleased to be here today and welcome Dr. Maëlle Lavener, Professor Neil Cummins, and Leah Erieniu, to both our online audience and our audience here in the Sheikh Zayed Theater. Maëlle Lavener is a research fellow in racial inequalities at the LSE International Inequalities Institute, who works in the Atlantic Fellows for Socioeconomic Equity program as well. Maëlle specializes in colonial history with social historical approach to social change in the American and Caribbean post-slavery societies from the abolitions of slavery in the 19th century to these days. Professor Neil Cummins is a professor of economic history in the Department of Economic History at LSE. He works at the intersections of big data and economic history to exploit recently digitize historical genealogical data and answer questions about the origins of modern economic and demographic behavior. Leah Erieniu, who has joined us online, is an Atlantic Fellow for Social Economic Equity and a feminist political economist analyst with more than 10 years of experience working on women's rights and gender justice issues across Africa. Her work engages with macro-level economic policy in the fields of public finance, reproductive justice, and labor rights. So today, we will be exploring racial and ethnic inequalities from the 19th century to the present day to unravel the legacy of past injustices and investigate the link between power, politics, and belonging. For any Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. I would ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. So as usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to the panel. For our online audience, you can please submit your questions using the Q&A feature and the platform. Please include your name and affiliation. And for those of you who are here in the theater, we will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. Please raise your hand and wait for the steward with the roving microphone to get to you. And please let us know your name and affiliation as well. I will try to ensure a range of questions from both our online audience and our audience here in the theater. With this, Maëlle, the floor is yours for your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fialho. I've been working on racial inequalities at the intersection of social and economic inequalities in the Caribbean plantation societies for 2 years now, through a comparative analysis including Jamaica as a former British colony, Guadeloupe and Martinique as former French colonies, which are part of the 18 regions that make up France today. My argument is that we cannot understand some colonial legacies and their contemporary features if we dismiss the role played by a racist ideology which framed the politics of emancipation in the United Kingdom and in France after the abolitions of slavery in their colonies in 1833 and 1848, respectively. This ideology legitimated the politics which have confined formerly enslaved people and a large part of African descendants in a broad situation characterized by less opportunities in terms of social mobility, a greater exposure to social precarity going hand in hand with racial inequalities and discriminations today in the 21st century. A crucial point of this research is to highlight the need to develop comparative analyses as well as socio-historical analyses to understand socio-racial inequalities inherited from colonial slavery. My work shows that social sciences can understand in depth the common malaise that affects a majority of people of African descent in many different places today, including the United States, and this beyond their very different political contexts. First of all, what is of great significance is that when we talk about the Caribbean, we don't talk about a very small area in this world that doesn't matter. We don't talk about what maybe is considered in your imaginary as just exotic places to have fun or just a so-called painting of underdeveloped lands. Due to the colonization of Americas and the creation of what they call the New World by Western European kingdom at the end of the 15th century, the Caribbean was for many centuries one of the pillars in the development and the regulation of the global capitalism which leads the world we are living in. This close linkage between global capitalism and the development of economy, plantation economies and societies was established throughout the 17th century in Barbados, Guadeloupe, Martinique, and Jamaica, when 13 economic actors historically called Sephardic Jews from Holland brought the economic model of sugar plantation from Brazil to the Les Antilles and the Caribbean. This emergence of the sugar economy was actually funded by their very important assets and international connections that the implementation of this economic model of exploitation required. Today, all of these sweet foods that you enjoy every day made up of sugar are directly inherited from the model of this model of exploitation, the sugar plantation economy. My research tends to demonstrate that the consolidation of the sugar economy in the British and French colonies after the abolition of slavery, which could have marked a rupture, profoundly relied on a racist perception of African and blacks shared by most colonial administrators and policymakers within these two different empires. However, the contemporary consequences of this model of exploitation in the everyday life of millions of people are unfairly overlooked. Today, a significant number of media and institutions acknowledge anti-black racism is a problem in the United Kingdom. I don't know how many of you watch football games, for example, or the Premier League. Personally, and Dr. Fialo do know that, I've been a big Manchester City fan for more than 10 years. I know you won't like it. We are in London, right? So I can understand, and my apologies for Arsenal once again. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that even in the Premier League, we can see the players wearing these t-shirts with the badges, no room for racism. Nonetheless, if we agree to consider racism as an important problem, fighting against racism today should be also regarded as a way to erase and repair structural inequalities generated by racism in the past. This is about racial inequalities that African-descended people from Caribbean plantation societies still bear the brunt in the United Kingdom, in France, as well as in Jamaica, Guadeloupe, and Martinique, their former colonies. And this is a fundamental point if we want to foster more equitable societies for our next generations in the future. The desire to excel is not, I think, wanting in the Negro character, and much of the future prosperity of these islands much depends upon its right direction. Firstly, I want you to understand that the abolitions of slavery in Jamaica and in Martinique and Guadeloupe have not marked a rupture in their colonial hierarchies because racist ideology was integral to what I name the progressive vision of emancipation for the masses of enslaved people. The term emancipation historically represents the moment when enslaved people were granted freedom after several centuries of rebellions. It seems to be very common today to talk about the importance of a racist and white supremacist ideology characterizing the general perception of black people by former slave owners, some planters, some administrators in the 19th century. Nevertheless, a key point that researchers have not sufficiently highlighted is the significant presence of a widely shared thinking among policymakers and administrators who identify themselves as progressive compared to the traditional racism expressed by the conservative opinion. The quote presented here is from Lord Elgin, the governor of Jamaica between 1842 and 1846, and he illustrates very well his thinking. The context is that the emancipation process started with the apprenticeship in Jamaica and the British colonies between 1834 and 1838, with the fear of seeing formerly enslaved people fleeing the rock on plantations because of a so-called idleness of African people who would be not enough civilized to be able to enjoy more than basic needs and therefore who would not work hard by nature in order to address their primitive needs. This thinking was expressed by Magistrate Chamberlain, for example, straight away at the announcement of the full emancipation in 1838. It's important to note that Chamberlain was not a white administrator, but categorized as they called brown or mulatto. And he asked enslaved people to prove now, in August 1838, that they can be part of the civilization by working responsibly for more needs. A discourse analysis tends to demonstrate that 10 years later, the same thinking with very similar words was expressed in the public announcement of the abolition of slavery in Guadeloupe by the Governor Laird in May 1848. So Elgin's thinking belongs to this progressive vision. Like Lionel Smith, former governor of Jamaica between 1836 and 1839, Elgin was really intended to work towards the emancipation of ex-slaves and the development of a new order of social relations. But at the same time, Elgin equated the benefit of the freedom for ex-slaves with the development of the Christian civilization in order to modify their habits and social behavior. If you're still wondering, the racist dimension of this thinking is the idea that African civilizations are inferior to European civilization, and therefore Africans and blacks without education and the process of assimilation are culturally, mentally, and morally inferior to whites. Therefore, what I identify as a racist progressive ideology in British and French colonies at the time of emancipation is this idea shared by a majority of policymakers that in spite of the natural inferiority of blacks, they are perfectible. Instead of claiming the continuity of floggings to make them work properly, as conservatives claimed, if they can access European civilization, education, and integrate the moral values of the great civilization, they would readily understand that they have to work hard on the plantation and have to participate in the wealth of the islands and their metropoles. The second, but no less important point that I would like to expound is that the so-called progressive but racist ideology remained visible in the emergence of a new modern world after World War II and during the decolonization process. The idea that the masses made up largely of people of African descent and that they were not sufficiently educated and civilized to make the most of political democracy and social progress remained observable in the 1940s and the 1950s in a very different context, the contemporary context which still characterizes the world in which we live today. This racist progressive vision was much more expressed in the decision-making process by French policymakers. In the case of Jamaica, the challenge of the United Kingdom is well illustrated in different reports made by the Governor Hugh Foote in office between April 1951 and November 1957. This statesman solely worked on the framing of the political evolution imposed by the decolonization by ensuring that Jamaica political elites would follow the right direction. That meant preserving the colonial interest of the United Kingdom, along with the integration of Jamaica economic developments in the new patterns designed by the Western nations and the World Bank. Of course, Governor Foote mentioned at several times the fragility of a modern political life in Jamaica, with the masses that he regarded as ignorant and not enough educated. However, Foote was very satisfied with Jamaican elites' behavior and political leaders, especially Norman Manley, who was leading the People's National Party. And as the historian Trevor Monroe has noticed, Foote described Jamaica as the best example of the decolonization process. What can we finally understand with the second point? Following two different ways, the acceptance of the idea according to which European civilization and models are the greatest by local leaders in Jamaica, Guadeloupe, and Martinique could not allow them to question the continuity in economic and social structures, along with the colonial hierarchization in the new global context emerging after World War II. It's nonetheless important to note that in the case of the French West Indies, this acceptance was fostered by a terrible colonial repression between 1948 and 1967, characterized by the killings of an important number of strikers, essentially in the sugar industry, and the slaughter of May 1967 in Guadeloupe. The continuity in economic and social structures after World War II is important to understand my final point, which concerns the long-term incidences of the racist progressive ideology in the structuring of social racial inequalities from the abolitions of slavery to nowadays. Let's read this quote from Major Bonner in 1939. The color question. The problem of interracial relations is obviously one of outstanding importance. The survival of slave owner mentality is in itself sufficient to account for a certain attitude of jealousy towards any progress made by the black man. The worker could find himself with partial employment, inadequate nourishment and bad housing, eyed resentfully the conditions in which his white employer lived. With insufficient education, the African regarded the material comfort of the European community as evidence of an undue share in the profit of industry. The context of this quote is the Great Depression of the 1930s, which culminated in the labor unrest in the West Indies, the big hunger march in Martinique in 1934, the rebellions of 1937, 1938 in Jamaica, and coincided with the creation of the first workers' unions in Jamaica and Martinique. In fact, during the first years following the abolition of slavery, the racist progressive vision of emancipation was associated with the economic liberalism emerging in Great Britain and legitimate arbitrate a series of decisions which would consolidate in Jamaica, Guadeloupe, and Martinique this plantation economy based on sugar production for a very long time, until the 1960s. I can mention the control of land possession to impede enslaved people from developing a large alternative economic model based on ground provisions, with the search for an economic freedom since the apprenticeship that historian Gad Human has brilliantly emphasized. The colonial desire to hold the land in the hands of the plantocracy was illustrated, for instance, by the Act 3429 for raising a tax on land, which passed Jamaica Assembly on the 6th December 1841. In Guadeloupe, in the days after the abolition of slavery, a similar fiscal measure was erected by the governor for the same purpose. I can also mention the priority given to work on plantations of a scholarship for the children and the use of schools to promote agricultural labor expected by planters. Moreover, a drastic control of spatial mobility through the application of metropolitan rules on vagrancy. Nonetheless, the most important measures were firstly the introduction of a new labor force, essentially the indentured workers from India, in order to lessen the amounts of wages and undermine a room for wage negotiations with the black workers. Secondly, the financial compensation granted to slave owners at the amount of £20 million in the British colonies and £126 million in the French colonies. In the case of the French West Indies, the financial compensation was directly used to create colonial banks and a new local banking system, benefiting the big planters, which played an important role in the preservation of colonial hierarchies. In the case of Jamaica, there was the creation of the Colonial Bank, the forerunner to Barclays Bank and Republic Bank Limited, in May 1836. However, this colonial bank was dissociated to the compensation which played the major role in the case of Jamaica to sustain the economic system in place. Therefore, more than one century after the abolition of slavery, in 1960, the report of the Commission of Inquiry on the Sugar Industry of Jamaica could describe the housing conditions of plantation workers as inhuman. Above all, the report noticed the poverty affecting the great majority of workers, facing a high level of structural unemployment and underemployment, and estimated at approximately 80% of the field workers. The situation described by the Major Bonner actuated thousands of Jamaicans to emigrate to the United Kingdom after the Second World War with the idea of social emancipation. In Guadeloupe and Martinique, the emigration to Paris was just as important as that of the British colonies. Today, in Jamaica, if some families of planters have not been able to withstand the neoliberalization of the 1980s, certain families continue to belong to the economic oligarchy, shared with multinational groups, Syrian and Chinese families. In the French West Indies, the economy is largely dominated by the group Bernard Ayotte, descendants of slave owners since the beginning of the plantation economy, a group created in 1934 and which achieved a turnover of €3 billion in 2021. On the other side, in these French islands, still largely made up of African descendants, 34% of the population lived below the national poverty line in Guadeloupe in 2017, and 12% of the population was classified in a situation of extreme poverty. In Martinique, 27% of the population lived below this national poverty line in 2020, twice as much as in mainland France. In 2017, Jamaica, in the tourist industry, which represents the second economic sector, the average wage of employees was estimated around £200 per month in the hotels. And to conclude, I would like to talk about the racial inequalities that affect Black Caribbeans and the United Kingdom. The Color of Money, a report made by Winnie Mate in 2020, emphasized the racial inequalities. And these inequalities in terms of access to employment, even for graduates, inequalities in terms of child poverty. So this is how today we can understand the impact of the racist ideology, which played an important role after the abolition of slavery and contributed to masses of African descended people at the bottom of the colonial hierarchies, still in place in Jamaica, Guadeloupe, and Martinique, without forgetting the case of those who emigrated to the United Kingdom after the Second World War. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Mayo, for your brilliant presentation. Professor Cummings?
Oh, great. Okay, thank you. Thanks for the invitation to speak, Mel. It's great to be here. What I'm going to talk about here relates to a point that Mel finished on, and it's the idea that we know there are inequalities along the ethnic group dimension in contemporary England. We know very little about that, and we know very little. We only know about it in very rough resolution, and we know nothing about the history of this. So the context here is that I am someone who specializes in data, big data, and what I've done in my career to date is been to try and account for the history of inequality and social mobility over the very long run in England, but really not looking at this ethnic dimension. But what's been kind of interesting in the kind of data space recently is that there's been a mass digitization of historical records where we can go back and look at them. And what we've got in there are names and also places of birth. So we can look at migrants and also ethnic groups, the way we can infer roughly by someone's name and look at this extra dimension of inequality. And the extra connection here that I'm going to talk to you today about is that the history of migration in this country, very much post-Second World War, which Mayle referenced having a different character than what was happening before that, but very much historically in this country, the other migrant coming in, depressing wages, being a different religion, seen as uneducated, dirty, and animalistic in many sense, has been the Irish. Okay, so what we've got here is a case study, okay, of a group that was a kind of a history of migration that has a lot of trauma in terms of the Irish famine of the mid-19th century. But coming into an industrializing Britain in the mid-19th century, where people were not always very welcome necessarily by the local population. And just to attest to this, this is a quote from Karl Marx, and it's from his personal letters. And this is very much kind of maybe, you know, summarizing just what the position was. And just to kind of give you a sense of it, you know, in all the big industrial centers in England, there is a profound antagonism between the Irish proletariat and the English proletariat. The average English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who lowers wages and the standard of life. He feels national and religious antipathy for him. He regards him somewhat like the poor whites of the southern states of North America regard their black slaves. So I would suggest that the Irish in England don't have this problem today in this dimension. But what can we learn from the Irish in England in terms of their pattern of assimilation and economic integration into the English socio-economic landscape? And what does that tell us for, you know, the future in terms of this very, very, diverse Britain that we live in, which has quite a profound degree of ethnic level inequality in terms of health, wealth, income, access to education. So there are these issues. Now, so like I'm just swimming in big data and algorithms, and I love all that stuff. So basically what I've done is collected masses of amount of historical data. But the difference to what others have done in the past is this is all named data. And so what you can use are techniques to infer things that were never asked in the first place. So they never asked people whether they're Irish, where they were born in the census sometimes. But these are probate records, so wealth data. And what we've done here is basically just use the names and use multiple different methods to just see how these names cluster together. And then you can see the degree to which there's kind of social differentiation between these groups, and then you can pick out the Irish, the Scottish, and all these other different groups, Jewish community, for example, lots of historic migration, but also, you know, some interesting history of certain Muslim groups as well. And these are all picked out in the data. And obviously, I'm skipping a heck of a lot here, but what really emerges from this is a story of consistent, disadvantage for the Irish in England when you measure them this way. And what you see is a persistent penalty in terms of wealth, but also in terms of the infant mortality rates of Irish children. They're at least 25% plus higher than those of the native English. And so what's interesting here is I've just completed a study on this, trying to understand what are the relative roles of systemic discrimination in the labour market? What's the role of the sending country? What was the nature of migration from Ireland? We think that there was perhaps more of a, what you might call a working class flow. And, you know, if these people had stayed in Ireland, maybe they would have been just as poor. We're not so sure. But what we can do, in terms of everyone else, is actually do this for a large number of different, like, ethnic groups as well. And what's amazing about this is, let me tell you, this does not work for every ethnic group particularly well, but think about it as a noisy signal. And there's going to be a different signal-to-noise ratio the way you look at this. And for some groups, it might be close to zero. For others, like the Irish, Bangladeshi, Pakistani communities, you can identify people from that background pretty well by their name. Not perfectly, but well enough that we can speak to issues of inequality. So I think this can be expandable, and I've also been exploring that. And I think also for groups in which you can't identify them by their surname, which there are many, particularly from the Caribbean as well. But basically, when you think about distinctive forename, surname contributions, what I'm telling you is I think the future with the historical big data can tell us about the history of inequality at better resolution than the best contemporary reports, which you referenced, which are very crude categories, by the way. And so what this leads into is a picture of social dynamics in England, which allows us to kind of understand the nature of capitalism and the nature of the economy. Is there an equalizing force? Is opportunity equal? To what extent is your outcome in life determined at birth by the wealth of your parents and their ethnic background? So this is just combining this figure, a bunch of my earlier research, and you can see here is the average English at one, and this is just wealth. We can do this for health and infant mortality, but comparing, just within the English, and the idea here is, are the Irish just the same as the poor English? And they're the poor Irish who maybe migrated to England, maybe the richer Irish migrated to the United States, or stayed. And then you can see what's happening here is that you can define these groups in the mid-19th century. Very, very poor families. Very, very rich families, right? And what you see here is that dashed line indicates where we just see what happens, their descendants, these family groups. And what you see is there's this social gravity, we call it regression towards the mean. And what you have is the rich stay rich, but not as rich as they were in the past. They're moving towards a societal mean. And this is happening for the poor as well. And the Irish are there too. We're at the level of the poor English in the mid-19th century. But you see that green line doesn't experience the same socioeconomic correlation between generations. We call it the intergenerational social mobility parameter. We call it beta, because we want to be, geeky about these things. But there's a different beta, because if they were at the same beta, they should be hitting that line just the way the poor English are hitting that line as we get to the end of the 20th century. The Irish are staying poor. And I think, not that I've identified any smoking gun for, say, systemic discrimination in the labour market or anything else, all I'm saying is a much more humble proposition is that we now have a lot of data that can basically give us hard numbers to kind of talk about the issues that Mail has described. And I think that it's quite an exciting time, because you can look at these numbers and look at how these things are changing. For kind of these kind of parameters, which really are fundamental for our social fabric. So with that, I'll conclude for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Cummings, for your comments. Leah, who has joined us online, the floor is yours for your comments and considerations.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hello, everyone. It's really nice to join you from Kampala, Uganda here. Thank you so much to Neil and Mael so far for your presentations, because I feel that to some extent they've provided some great grounding for some of the issues that I'm going to talk about today. Looking at a more contemporary form of inequality observed within the migration of patterns of Ugandan women migrating as domestic workers to the Gulf states, but rooting this analysis within issues around gender and racialization. So when flying out of Entebbe, which is Uganda's international airport, you're more likely than anything to meet a group of young women huddled together. They're typically wearing uniform. Some of them would be wearing hijab as well. And sometimes they'll have a company name scrawled, printed in large bold letters on t-shirts that they're wearing. Their destination, sometimes Kuwait, sometimes Oman, sometimes Qatar, sometimes the United Arab Emirates, but probably Saudi Arabia, which is the country that Uganda has a bilateral agreement with to externalize domestic labor. These young women are on their way to serve as domestic workers, to cook, to clean, look after children, do any range of tasks for about $240 a month, more money than the average Ugandan sees in about a year. So when they get to the Gulf, they will serve the needs of a leisure class for whom hiring domestic work is itself a mark of class. So the oil boom in the 1970s in the Gulf triggered a demand for migrant domestic workers, particularly from Southeast Asia, you know, specifically for domestic workers in line with this growing wealth and a new culture of conspicuous consumption. But the migration of domestic workers from Africa is a more recent phenomenon. This migration is mediated by a bargains truck between the Gulf states and their citizens, where the state basically guarantees a leisured lifestyle for them by facilitating controlled migrant flows that provide cheap labor instead of the state doing some sort of public provisioning. So what we see is wealthy women in the Gulf, through the benefits of their class position, being able to quote unquote hire a wife and transferring their roles as housewives and its social scripts of social reproduction to other poorer racialized women, of course, without the commensurate privilege and status. So to link this phenomenon to today's conversation, I have a couple of arguments for, I hope I'll have enough time to go through them, but let's see. So the first argument that I have, that I make, is that this externalization of labor from Uganda to the Gulf is a continuation of colonial and imperialist exploitation of the periphery for the development of the semi-periphery and the core. And the semi-periphery here being the Gulf states that used to be a buffer to the imperial core. When you think about looking at Samir Amin's categorization of Africa's integration into capitalist economies, particularly looking at the colonial relations of extraction, it's a pretty good lens with which to consider this contemporary export of labor. So we used to have the Africa of the concession companies ruled by charter, Africa of the cash crop economy, of which Uganda was among, producing cotton, coffee, and the like, and Africa of the labor reserve. Samir Amin's labor reserve economy typify economic policies of white settler colonialism you know, using administrative, legal, and financial machinations to create a class of laborers for capitalist accumulation. What we see with domestic workers being transported to the Gulf is the extension of this commodified labor to an international terrain, but this time with a focus on reproductive labor. Of course, in response to what I talked about earlier, more advanced economies desire for cheap labor to subsidize social reproduction, a cost that the neoliberal state no longer wants to cover or no longer has the capacity to cover. So this uptick in migration is a result of processes of accumulation by dispossession. In the case of Uganda, directly linked to the structural adjustment programs of the 80s and the 90s, which unleashed an economic whiplash, disappearing not only opportunities for education, but making work very precarious. So let's take a look at the numbers. I really liked Neil's presentation and the geeky graphs. I really love that, although I have no such big data to provide. When we look at 2022 in Uganda, we had about 85,000 Ugandans migrate into the Gulf Cooperation Council, and with Saudi Arabia taking the lion's share of migrant workers. Out of these, about 72% were women domestic workers, so you're already seeing the gender dimensions. When we look at remittances coming specifically from the Gulf, and the majority of it coming from Saudi Arabia, we have about $1.3 billion in remittances. In the grand scheme of things, that's not a lot of money, but Uganda is a very, very small economy. When you contrast that money with the amount of revenue generated from coffee export, which is Uganda's chief agricultural export from the colonial period, it comes to just about $600 million. So you can see that remittances are, as somebody described, quite a cash cow and a place of interest. So we could argue that then Uganda is moving from being a cash crop economy to a labor reserve economy because of the current economic system that we exist in. The second thing I want to consider is more related to some of the things that my colleagues have talked about, which is the ways in which racialization creates precarity and reproduces inequalities. So I want to talk about the ways in which bordering and migration policy serves as a race-making regime within the Gulf, particularly looking at the issue, the system of kafala, which is not very different from many migration sponsorship systems. Any person that's working on a visa within the UK knows that you have to get a sponsor. And that is typically what happens with the kafala system in the Gulf as well. And this is because migration usually triggers contestations in citizenship as it tends to disrupt the racial and class order. So there is a desire to control who comes in and who stays out. When we look at the migration of Irish women to the US or the migration of African-American women after the emancipation within the US itself, we can see the ways in which race was used as an instrument to thwart their upward social mobility by mobilizing discourses around race. So Neil already talked about, a discourse around dirt and lack of civilization and primitiveness being used for Irish people. And that was obviously exactly the same experience in the US. But then on the other hand, the other group that was being described that way were Black people. So then as evidence of race as something that is socially constructed, you see that both Irish and Black people are categorized as inferior. And the Irish basically are tainted by having a domestic worker identity that the Black people also have. So when you look at the Gulf itself, while Ugandan domestic workers do embody the markers of race through their skin color because they are Black, because of the work they perform, which is dirty and demeaning domestic work, it simply confirms their Blackness and therefore their suitability for that work. So the kafala system basically corrals women and creates a system of surveillance and ensuring that they are only available to do this work. And the kafala system then creates some sort of racial stratification based on race, class, and nationality that produces differential treatment of workers. So there are other migrants in the Gulf that are professional, that are in professional roles. But most of these tend to come from the global north, and they are hired as experts, not as migrants, and they are not subjected to the strictures of kafala. So they're hired for the symbolic superiority denoted by their whiteness. And to again illustrate the ways in which race is socially constructed, even if you're Black or Asian, as long as you come from a global North country, that catapults you to the top of the kafala hierarchy. So quote unquote, you're considered white. So basically the job that you do determines your race. So the domestic workers that are migrating to the Gulf to do cleaning work then are basically stuck in that position with no opportunities whatever for social mobility. So with kafala, migrants are always temporary, they're always foreign, and they are placed outside the nation state and outside the bounds of belonging. So there's some people who call this transient servitude, contending that this practice manages the contradiction of the desire for foreign labor and the rejection of the person who embodies it, in this case is the African women. So kafala does not just create a citizen, non-citizen boundary, but it constructs a racial other through its asymmetrical treatment of migrants depending on class and nationality. But it's important for us to understand, and that's why I talked about sponsorship within the UK at risk of essentializing or orientalizing, that kafala, while being specific to the Gulf, is not unique. The instrumentalization of social categories to exploit is a key feature of capitalist accumulation, which necessarily seeks to dehumanize and to objectify. And we can see that exhibited in other visa regimes as well. I would now like to turn to the issue of gender, looking specifically at how it entangles with the logics of race and class to produce a racialized and gendered domestic worker identity that enables the entrenchment of African women's exploitation. So the low class and gender position of migrant domestic workers interacts with migration policy to objectify and commodify women, stripping them of their proprietorship over their labor and enforcing a master-servant relationship reminiscent of slavery. Actually, when you take a look at the bilateral agreement signed between Uganda and Saudi Arabia, you will see language like absconding, you'll see language like runaway, which basically means that when a domestic worker runs away because they need to seek permission from their employer, if they leave their place of work without getting that permission, or they leave the country without getting that permission, they are described as having absconded from duty or having run away, which is language that is reminiscent of slavery. So for transnational living domestic workers, their work spatially and socially isolates them from family and support networks, making them available without any limitations as they become part of the employer's family. So they're available 24 hours a day, which is a breach of contract. Again, no control over their own labor, which is reminiscent of slavery. So in other words, the fact that domestic workers live where they work means that their employers have control over their professional and personal lives. Moreover, with kafala, combined with a cultural understanding of the home as sacrosanct, and beyond state control, exclude domestic workers from protections accorded by labor laws. And if you contrast this with male migrant workers who do more public jobs, the male migrant workers have a bit more freedom. So we could say that we can see kafala as limiting the degree of domestic workers' proprietorship over their labor and creating a gendered and differential treatment of migrant workers. So very lastly to close, I know I'm over time. I think the question that I kept asking myself was, why women, why these women, and why is there a muted public protest to these practices, at least when you come to the Ugandan context? And my thinking is that the migration of African women for domestic work in service of those high in a socially constructed racial hierarchy is not surprising. Perhaps if the migration were in reverse, that would be in the case. That would be the case. What we're seeing is that there is the post-colonial state lacks the capacity to fend for its own citizens, and instead actively participates in making them available for precarious work. Remember the amount of remittances that I mentioned earlier. So domestic workers and migrants in general are now being seen as some of the biggest contributors to foreign aid because of just how difficult the economic environment is. So one of the arguments I make is that the state creates a reserve army of labor for export, actively playing a role as a labor broker. And in this case, I'm talking about the Ugandan state. So while it does not directly recruit workers, it creates a pipeline for migration through a labor externalization program it has created. So I could, in closing, I could say that by funneling domestic workers through the kafala system, moreover with the understanding that they are not protected, the state is complicit in the production of inequalities currently that are experienced by migrant domestic workers from Uganda. And the state also colludes in the racialized, institutionalized humiliation of its citizens. I'll stop there, thank you.
So thank you so much for your presentations. I will now open the floor to questions from the audience, both here and online. If you are online, please type your short questions into the Q&A box, and we will try to answer as many as possible. And please, if possible, include your name and affiliation. For those here, please raise your hand, and we will select questions in rounds. Please wait for a steward with a roving microphone to get to you and let us know your name and affiliation. Just as a quick comment, we may go a couple of minutes over time because I am assuming we have we'll have some questions to be addressed. So if you have any questions, please raise your hand.
Hi there. All really, really fantastic talks. I do appreciate it. You probably answered this question already. My name is Avais. I'm a sociology teacher. I was just wondering, how do you respond to those people who are like, colonialism was this amount of years ago. You can't keep blaming us. The real problems in these underdeveloped countries are just corruption and poor governance, etc. How would you respond to people that say these types of things? Thank you.
Hello, thank you so much for everyone participating. My name is Tala. I'm a student at a master's student at UCL, and I specifically want to address my question to Leo. Thank you so much for speaking about this topic, and the kafala system is a terrible system, and I'm curious to know about how Ugandan society, how the issue is viewed, and is there a sort of pressure or encouragement for young girls to go down that path, or are the flaws of the system viewed as well and understood in Ugandan society? So how is the whole system viewed from the Ugandan side and for young girls?
Would you like to answer now?
Yeah. So thank you for the question. I would say to address this kind of question about the relevance of maybe understanding the colonial legacies in our societies, I could just address it by this kind of work. I mean, just the idea that scientifically and with methods in social sciences, how we can really trace from one starting point to today a real continuity in terms of economic and social structures. But I talked about it, at a macro scale, but to go deeper, we can also try to focus on some, you know, families' trajectories, and with some specific case, just enlighten this continuity in different cases. That's all I can say. I believe that social sciences, with this socio-historical approach that I want to develop to social change in the post-slavery societies, can just help to, you know, have another perspective and another understanding of these inequalities that I talked about are not just about the past, but a part of the present time.
Any additional questions we have? Maybe here.
There is the question for Leah.
Go ahead.
The question for me, but I would also just like to tackle very briefly the one about colonialism, you know, was so long ago, and therefore, you know, should people still be talking about the past? Currently, it's because of issues of governance, it's issues of corruption. And I would say that all those contemporary issues, very much like Mael has said, are very much tied to the way in which the colonial state was created. And it was never intended to be a thriving state. It was put there basically for purposes of extraction. But more specifically, I'll say that post-independence, that in the case of Africa, you know, the trajectory was on the up and up until the 70s and the 80s. So you could say that African countries have never been given enough time and opportunity for them to create their own economic policies to see them through to the end. When that had just started happening, then you have Reagan and Thatcher happening, and then you have the current system of neoliberalism that we are dealing with and all its discontents. I won't go into the details of that, but personally, I think that those are the things that we're dealing with, and an opportunity was never given, sufficient opportunity. As to the ways in which the Ugandan public regards the externalization of labor from Uganda to the Gulf. So my dissertation actually did a discourse analysis on newspaper reportage of on stories about women migrating to the Gulf, exactly to be able to understand those sentiments and where people stand. So there are several things, you know, anecdotally, there's a lot of hand-wringing, particularly when you hear stories of abuse and torture and things like that. And people will constantly say, bring back our girls, our women are suffering. But there are no jobs. There are no prospects available, so people have no choice. So you see that poorer families will do whatever it is in their power. They'll sell off some assets if they have to, so that they can send off someone who will be able to make so much more money that would be able to help the rest of the family. The second thing is, there is this tension between that the government inhabits of, on the one hand, disavowing this labor export, and on the other hand, embracing it as well. So the labor externalization program exists as a government program. If you hear the president speak, you would think that it is he's an opposition politician, because he's constantly saying, you know, he'll say, you know, do you see South Koreans exporting their people? You know, Ugandans need to stay and till the land and things like that. We should not be exporting our people. So there is this little dance that is constantly happening with the government saying, oh, this is disgusting. We should not be taking our people to serve as slaves, and at the same time creating a pipeline for them to actually go and do that, because the government benefits from this significantly. Actually, what the migration does is that it releases the pressure valve, because otherwise you have an immersive, an enormous youthful population that has no jobs, and you need to do something about it. Otherwise, we will descend into anarchy. So they know that, yes, let us keep sending them. And so they'll be able to provide money for their families, but at the same time, the state is actually able to collect significant non-tax revenue from all the fees that emerge from the migration industry.
Julia, we have time for one more round of quick questions. Well, there are a lot of, let's start from this side now. Let's start, one, two, and three.
Thank you very much. Ewan Grant, United Kingdom Defence Forum, but here in a personal capacity. My work does involve looking at the geopolitics of human trafficking, and the lady's point, well, it's things, many things that happened at Entebbe Airport are still relevant today, and certainly the lady's made powerful comments on that. Thank you. My question is the UN, and particularly the International Labour Organization, increasingly effective or more likely ineffective given the rise of China in international organizations and its policy of ask no questions and do not interfere in internal affairs? Thank you.
We did a project in Memphis, and the most shocking part for me was there is two segregations. There are poor white females who go to this famous church, and the priest tells them every Sunday everything is okay, while nothing is okay. It stays the same. And I thought that was, for me, I had to leave the church. I found it so false what this guy was doing. And then on the other side, you have the black population in Memphis, which we also had interactions with, because it was around how can you make Memphis a better city that actually serves everybody, etc. And what I learned, actually mostly from our employees, that they said, because they went to a theater, that a gallerist in New York who is from Memphis, he moved back and opened a theater because, as you know, people of color weren't allowed in museums. They couldn't go to festivals. That was all just for the white for a very long time. And you could see in that young generation today that they still don't understand what is theater. So are they real? Is this what they play of their life or something? So I thought it has a long-term impact on the life of these people.
Thank you. We have one final question here. Sorry, we are running a little bit over time, so we take this as the last question.
Monique Schwartz, Better Practice Advisors. I wanted to ask about reparation, whether that is a possibility, and include the Irish population in that as well, and Africa and the Caribbean and America. Because I think if we look at our history, there are communities that have had reparation, Jewish community, which I did in. But I was wondering whether that is a possibility and what form you think it would take.
Thank you for the questions. I will ask our panelists to be concise in their questions, in their answers.
Thank you very much for this last question. About the question of reparations, I would say yes, it should be a possibility if it's collectively, if collectively people in the different nations concerned by this problem can just acknowledge that yes, something is possible. And to me, it goes beyond my role personally as an academic, but the idea is that this kind of reflection, they have to just, you know, feed the reflection of different people and maybe push this kind of idea. And the facts talk by themselves, and I believe that if in different countries today, different countries that have this imperial history, a lot of people can acknowledge that it should be fairer to establish something different and to repair these inequalities and these impacts that we agree that they have a long-term incidences. Yes, that would be possible. It's something that people have to be involved in.
Lia and Yu, would you like to add briefly to Mayo's comment?
Yes, absolutely. So every time we have conversations about reparations, I like to reference Dr. Chigumadzi Panache, who's written a brilliant essay called "With What Are You Apologizing?" And she says that in seeking to repair, we can't just say we're sorry. You can't just say sorry with your mouth. There has to be some sort of material reparations that are made as well. And right now, when we're looking at discourse and reparations, it's still about, you know, all the countries that cause this harm are thinking about liability to themselves. And, you know, at this point, we are still just talking about reparations related to colonialism and imperialist plunder. And as that happens, the conversation is now already shifting to even climate reparations, because in terms of contemporary inequalities, we are already contending with climate breakdown with an outsized contribution from somewhere else, from the global north. So we need to expedite these conversations, but I think it starts from an understanding and an acknowledgement that there is indeed a debt that needs to be paid. For some Africans, that debt literally is in the form of the sovereign debt that they owe right now. And they're saying, if we're looking at the Jubilee debt campaigns, to say that, forgive the debt, cancel the debt, and that would be one of the forms of reparations. Reparations should not come through official development assistance or any of the other grants that are currently being provided by, but with an unconditional cancellation of the debt. So that is what I'll say. I did not understand very clearly the other question that was posed at me, unfortunately. But thank you so much.
And you?
Okay, well, very briefly. On the reparations idea, so related research in the US has been looking at the historical black-white wealth gap to motivate the specifics and general argument towards reparations, say, for the US black population with the legacy of slavery. So this is maybe going back to the first question about why the past matters, because we want to see maybe, like, if certain communities are still underprivileged, that there is this legacy of just maybe being caught in this intergenerational poverty trap. And if there is some sort of injustice that we can fix now, I mean, I see my role as being a social scientist primarily in assessing where we are, like, you know, and seeing the facts, which together we as a society, specialists and non-specialists, can decide how we want to address this. Defenses of capitalism generally invoke that inequality might be permissible if everyone actually has a fair chance of being in the top 1%, and it's kind of a random draw. But I think, like, what back to the first question, what historical research shows is that we can see the makeup of who is at the top of society, both in terms of their family background, their ethnic background, their educational background, and that enables us to understand where we're failing as a society. So I think it's really for us as social scientists to interpret the past and to explain why we're here, so we can make informed decisions about how we make a better future that, you know, is also sustainable given, you know, what I expect are, you know, forces that will increase inequality in the next few decades for our children. So, how we address this is really important, not just for the past, but for the future as well. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
So thank you so much to our speakers for a fascinating discussion, which I hope you all enjoyed. And thank you so much for your engaging questions. There are a lot more exciting events happening later today at the LSE Festival. So please do take a copy of the program on your way out. if you haven't got one already, or check out the program at lsc.ac.uk/festival. I would particularly recommend the Defending Democracy, Building Solidarity with Persecuted Writers, Journalists, and Artists, an event taking place at 2 p.m., which is organized by the International Inequality Institute. Finally, please join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.